I just want to talk about something I'm very proud to be part of. The Vietnam Traveling Memorial Wall coming to Cheshire. And we're linked up on the radio station website. There's all different events happening. And you should make it a point to bring your kids out.
Yeah.
And no one should ever forget that this happened.
Ever.
We're going to talk a little bit about that. But first, I want to talk to Dennis Mannion, United States Marine Corps Vietnam veteran. He was involved in one of the longest and bloodiest battles of the Vietnam War. Good morning, and thank you for your service.
Good morning. Good morning to the two of you. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Oh, you got that voice.
Yeah, you do. Yep. You just sound like combat right there.
Right. Right. You now, just made me piddle.
I'm surrendering right now.
He's a man's man.
I'm throwing down my weapons.
I'm like, okay, I give up.
You became Johnny Cash.
Probably allergies. I don't know.
Whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about this battle you were involved in?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I got to Vietnam in September of 1967, and I was assigned as an artillery forward observer to an infantry company.
What does that mean?
It's a forward observer's job is to, when you get in trouble, kind of locate where the trouble's coming from on a map with coordinates, figure out the coordinates, take a reading on a compass, and then call that in to an artillery battery, and then they rounds land, and you correct them. You'll say left 200, add 100, left 100, you know, or fire for effect, whatever it is.
Yeah, you are a troubleshooter.
Yeah, boom, boom goes there.
yeah, send boom, boom over there.
Right.
It was an officer's job, but I was only a PFC when I first got there, and there was a shortage of officers, so they made me the FO in my company. And my radio operator initially was a corporal. He technically outranked me, but it was just the two of us, two enlisted guys who had this officer's kind of responsibility for our company. And then we ran convoy duty and operations along the coast of Vietnam, up in the northern part of I Corps, just below the demilitarized zone. And it was nothing heavy or dramatic. And then on the 12th of December, we were sent, along with other infantry companies, to Khe Sanh, which was 28 miles to the west from the South China Sea, right on the Laotian, near the Laotian border. And it was the Marine Corps and the military in Vietnam's response to the buildup of North Vietnamese in that area. And eventually, when the siege started in mid-January, there were about, I don't know, 5,800 Marines there, but there were between, I don't know, estimates between 30 and 40,000 North Vietnamese soldiers who were in the hills and around the combat base. I was on one of the hills. So my vision was really looking down as opposed to being on the combat base and having to look up. And as the FO, our bunker where we dug it was really at the top of the hill 861, which is the height of the hill in meters above sea level.
And good position for you, but also not good for they could take it out.
Right.
No?
Well, yeah, they tried. I mean, they pounded the combat base as well, obviously. We lived in the ground for 77, over 80 days we lived in the ground.
All right, think about this. I just want everyone to just, when we think we have problems because we're stuck in traffic.
Yeah, right.
This guy was living in the ground, okay? It was it was December. The rest of the country was preparing for Christmas.
Yeah.
Buying and decorating trees. These guys are living in a friggin' ground in Vietnam.
Right. There's no cheese in your egg sandwich.
There's no thank you that's appropriate.
Yeah. Right. Yes, thank you.
When I do some remarks, I'll tell people that I last showered in a field shower, which was a brief kind of thing, at the end of Thanksgiving in 67. And it's real quick under the water, soap, get out, then go back in and rinse off. And that was the last time I saw soap and water or used soap and water until the end of April in 1968. Mm. Never washed.
From 67 to 68. Thanksgiving of 67.
Thanksgiving, Easter of 68, something like that. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, but that was just the nature of what we had to do. And the hill that I was on, there were Marines on three different hills, and you have to be on the high ground, otherwise you really are going to lose. You can ask the French about Dien Bien Phu in 1954 when they were massacred there, and that ended the war with France, Indochina, the Viet Cong or the NVA won. Ho Chi Minh and his people. So the Marines had that same sense that if there's hills, you have to be on them, and the hills have been fought for in the spring of 67, and now we're holding those hills to try to help protect the combat base. And the hill that I was on, if you scissored all the way around the trench line and lifted it up with a giant helicopter, you could put it onto a football field, beyond the goalpost, and onto the sidelines. It was not that big. And we did live literally in the ground. And up there, we didn't even have anything to dig with except e-tools, a little entrenching tool that you carry around on your back.
That little foldable shovel?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the only thing we had. And my bunker eventually that I was in, that we dug into the ground, it took weeks, was probably 10 feet in the ground and maybe 14 feet by 14 feet square.
And you dug that with a foldable shovel?
No.
With a little shovel and through the – and when eventually we got so deep, you had to throw the dirt – put the dirt into a helmet and throw it out. And the only part that helped us there was it's not like New England where you hit a rock every inch you dig. On 861, particularly this red clay soil, there were very few rocks, so we didn't have to deal with that.
Thank you for that.
And then we slept on C-ration cardboard. C-rations, the food comes in a box of 12, but it's wrapped around with this piece of cardboard and some wire that holds it on. And then we use those pieces of cardboard to sleep on for that time period.
Wow.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
And we got shelled every day. We got mortared every day. We were partially overrun the first morning of the siege, which was January 20th in 68. The NVA got through our lines pretty quickly, around midnight into the 20th and the 21st. But there were more of us left in the morning than they were, so we continued to hold the hill, and we did hold it for the rest of the siege.
How did you get your supplies? How did you get your food? How did you get your...
Everything on the hills came by helicopter. That's why I go by Sikorsky. I think of helicopters. I see a helicopter in the air. I'm always grateful. That's the only way we got food and water. Even water was brought in by helicopter. Ammunition first, water second.
Did they ever hit any of the helicopters coming into you?
Yes, they did. Oh. Yes, they did.
So it's close. It's like, food and water. Right. Oh, no.
Right.
Yeah, more importantly, the ammo.
Yeah, protected helicopter.
It depended. And they came with these CH-46s, the double blades, and they could carry, most of their loads were carried externally, hanging down, and then the only time the wheels would ever touch the LZ, which was not very big, but the only time the wheels would actually touch the ground was when people were being transferred off, wounded being left, but removed, KIAs being removed, or new people coming. That's the only time they put their wheels on the ground. Otherwise, they just flew over and got about 10 feet above the LZ and then released the net, and the net would have whatever they were delivering. And they would deliver multiple helicopters at a time, and then I didn't have LZ security. I didn't have to worry about the LZ. That was down below me anyway. But the guys who were there didn't even go out in the daytime. You had to wait until it got dark before you could go out there and get that stuff.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
You know, it's very dangerous.
Unbelievable.
And the good part about helicopters is they bring you stuff. The bad part is they make so much noise you can't hear. And you need to be able to hear. Your hearing and your eyesight is what can protect you. But with helicopters, you need them, and they make noise.
So is that when the enemy would strike, when helicopters were coming in?
They would try to time up their mortaring with that. Yes, it was usually mortars that they weren't using missiles like they're using in Ukraine now to knock helicopters out of the sky. They had RPGs, but they weren't going to be using them against helicopters then. That's when they would try to mortar, because they could see them coming. There wasn't any question, you know. And it used to be we had single helicopters come, and that's when a couple got shot down. And then they decided that somebody came up with the concept of what they called a super gaggle, and all the helicopters, like 9 or 10 of them, would circle at about 5,000 feet like a gaggle of geese, and the jets would come, and they would rocket and strafe, drop tear gas all around us, drop bombs, and then when they departed, the helicopters would come in one at a time right behind each other and drop their loads off.
Oh, man.
And once that happened, they never lost another helicopter. I don't know what it costs to run all those munitions.
Yeah.
But we weren't thinking of the money, obviously.
When they're dropping the tear gas, is that rolling into your area, too?
Sometimes, so, yeah. Yes. But they're saturating the hills that are at least 500 meters away. But, yeah, every once in a while it would. Every once in a while it would. But yeah, that wasn't an issue.
Were they using napalm?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. There was a ridge line that was almost the same height as 861 to the west. So the combat base was to the east, and looking to the west, there was a ridge line only 500 meters away, which is almost the same height as us, and that's what the NVA used to attack our hill from, and, you know, probe and mortar and RPGs and stuff from there. And they used to drop napalm on them all the time, and if the wind was just right at 500 meters, you could feel the heat when those big 750 pound canisters hit the ground.
Wow!
You'd get singed. You just felt the air get so warm.
Yeah.
From 500 meters away.
And you're okay. Like there's no.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I got wounded twice, once there and once later on. But I was really lucky, fortunate in that sense. So I consider myself really lucky, not that talented.
And no side effects or illnesses from the napalm.
No, not at all.
Well, he's talking about us, though.
Yeah. Holy crap. You know, yeah. You think about this, the kind of life that Dennis had.
Yeah.
Other soldiers. And then they came home to a place that wasn't like, hey, thank you.
Yeah.
Ugh, it's just,
I know.
It's gross.
Disgusting.
It's gross.
Well,
so this is why this...
That's how the
this is why this...
You know, it's... Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No,
it's kind of like... I mean, I grew up around people who had been in World War II, but in those years, as a kid, teenager, and a kid, you would never even think of saying thank you to people who served in World War II or Korea. I mean, that thank you is nice, and it came as a result of the treatment that Vietnam veterans as a group got coming back. You know, it's just normally
but
you just
the World
come
War
back
II veterans.
You,
there was a clear end to the war, so they returned
absolutely.
To ticker tape parades.
Yeah.
Yes,
and
exactly.
People drinking
right.
in the streets and like, yay, we
big
won.
Big celebration.
And
yeah, you couldn't buy a beer in a bar if you were a World War II veteran. Yeah, I mean, that's true. Absolutely correct. And the country had changed so much from 67 to 68 and weary of it, actually, that when we came home in different groups in different years, depending when you went over there, the treatment was, you know, I didn't get mistreated. As I say to people, I was a high school English teacher and football coach, but I no one ever spit on me. I mean, if they ever spit on me, I'd still be in prison. I'm telling you, I wouldn't let anybody.
I can hear that in your voice.
Yep.
You are not someone
nope.
I would even look.
Not even thought.
Nope.
Weird at.
Right. Yeah.
Or directly at.
Yeah.
I
wouldn't even.
And I did fly home from Vietnam. I went on a commercial. They chartered commercials. I flew from Da Nang to Coconut and spent a couple of days getting cleaned up and put our old uniform on. And then we flew a couple of days later to Okinawa. And I mean, to from Okinawa to L.A. and to El Toro, which is a Marine base outside LAX. And then I went up to the airport that night and I got on a plane to fly across the country in the midnight flight, red-eye flight. Leaving L.A. to Chicago and then on to Hartford. And I sat, half-empty plane, and I sat in a window seat, and the guy in a business suit sat on the aisle. There was a seat between us. And then he asked where I was, Cohen. I said, Connecticut. And he said, where have you been? I said, Vietnam. He said, did you see any action? I said, a little bit. And he said, oh, okay. And that he turned away and then did some stuff. And then we took off, and we're over the Pacific, then turning, making a big sweep. Now we're heading east. And I'm coming home, and the guy, as soon as the pilot took off the seatbelt restriction sign, he pushed the button, and the stewardess came up out of the dark because it's after midnight, the plane's kind of dark, and she said, yeah, can I help you? And he said, yeah, I need a seat on this airplane as far away from this individual as you can move me. And she said, oh, okay, and she gathered up his stuff and something out of the overhead and trundled off to the back of the plane. Didn't want to sit next to me.
Well, there's always true. Out that side door.
Yeah, what a turd that person was.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. No, it's just gross. It's
you
gross.
Know
I'm embarrassed of it. And this
well,
is the importance
okay.
of this traveling Vietnam War Memorial because we finally get to acknowledge what was lost, the sacrifices
yeah,
that people
absolutely.
Made.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, people went. Some people went voluntarily. Others enlisted because they didn't want to get drafted. Others were drafted. So people made a choice. And we had a different wall from from actually the organization down in Washington that owns the wall and monitors the wall. They came 15 years ago, and I made my remarks to the Cheshire High School kids that morning, and I said, it's like a yearbook. It's frozen in time, and yearbooks are that. When you look at you pull the old yearbook out, you don't say, this is what I was like. You say, this is what I, you can't say this is, you have to say, this is what I was. This picture is what I was. It's not what I am now. But for those veterans on the wall, that's the yearbook. Every name has a story, has a background, has photographs, probably, and it stops. There's no. It's like a yearbook. It's like a yearbook of the war. It's powerful.
Really impactful,
yeah,
and powerful.
Yes,
when you're in D.C. and you start from the lower,
yes,
end of the wall, and you,
yes,
just start,
absolutely,
walking, and it,
yes,
just keeps going, and it keeps getting higher,
yeah,
and it left me,
yes,
speechless, literally speechless.
Yeah, I've heard people who weren't veterans in war, or never were veterans in that war, who go there, and people who have never been in the service, and they go there, and they just get this overwhelming sense of history and emotion, and yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Exactly. It is, and you can see yourself in the wall. That's what's,
yes,
pretty.
The reflection.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really, that was,
yeah,
really remarkably well done.
Yes.
Dennis, so of, yeah, course you're going to be part of this event, and we're linked up. It's hosted, mm-hmm, by Because of the Brave. It's a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
Right.
The opening ceremonies are going to be at Bartlett Park in Cheshire on Main Street, June 2nd at 6:30. I think we should all go.
Yeah.
Like, everybody should be there.
Yes.
And
yeah,
the wall,
they're
going to
have an
Cheshire
opening ceremony in the morning, and bring it, just like 15 years ago, they're bringing all the kids from the high school across the street.
That's
all
great.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah,
great. We'll be there for the morning ceremony.
Yep.
The arrival.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I, for me personally, I'm very lucky, but there are 28 names on the wall that I can find. That's how lucky I was. So,
wow.
You know, it's not, I didn't make the greater sacrifice. They did, and there are certainly people who probably have more, but that's, for me, that's what it is. And some, I would say 8 to 10 of them were really close friends and somewhere nearby. So when they got killed, but that's just the nature of the beast.
Phil's wife Amanda texted and feels weird to say Phil's wife.
It does.
They,
oh, wow,
just,
yeah,
got married this weekend.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, brand new. But yeah, she grew up in Cheshire and she knows you. She was your neighbor.
Oh, really?
Amanda Garbatini. So she says hello.
Oh, yes,
she says,
absolutely,
she loves,
yeah,
you. Loves Dennis.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah, they used to live down the street. Yeah. Wow.
For old times' sake, say, get off my lawn.
Dennis, I want to have you on a million more times,
yeah,
before the wall comes in.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much. That, you know, words
I
can't
appreciate
do it.
That.
Thank
I do
you.
Appreciate that. Okay, good luck to you guys.
Thank you, sir.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.